This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Been more than 6 months since police officers shot and killed Breonna Taylor after forcing their way into her Louisville home. They were serving a no-knock warrant. Today, the Louisville Courier-Journal announced the state attorney general is expected to announce his decision in the Breonna Taylor case about whether or not to criminally charge the white officers who shot and killed the 26-year-old. As of noon, we do not have a decision yet. Federal and state officials have opened investigations into that botched raid to find out what happened, but there are still a lot of questions. A new documentary from the New York Times Presents weaves together the information, the documents that are available, to paint a picture of that night. The killing of Breonna Taylor also features interviews with Breonna's friends and family to illuminate who she was as a person. Just one of the topics we're going to talk about today on Back Channel, our series Connecting Culture and Context with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. We'll also remember actor Chadwick Boseman. We'll dig into the hit HBO show Lovecraft Country and look at the historical relationship between black women and voting rights. Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Natalie, give us your reaction to this documentary that you've seen, The Killing of Breonna Taylor.
Well, first of all, I really appreciate that the New York Times, whoever is responsible for, you know, greenlighting this project, hired a black woman to direct it. So I feel like Yoruba Richin's presence as director makes a difference. And I think that the film, although it's to me, as someone who loves documentary and is steeped in it, it doesn't quite do all of the things that I would want in a film devoted to someone like Breonna Taylor, right, who lost her life, still has not found any justice for her killing. But what I really appreciate about this film is that it gives us information and allows us to hear from people who knew Breonna best, but also you know, who know details that have not necessarily been revealed. There are people in the film who can explain what went down and give us a picture of what happened that night that really to this moment we haven't really seen in mainstream media. So I appreciate the film at the very least for the fact that it allows us to like put some of the myths to rest that have been circulating about Breonna, her criminality, her boyfriend's criminality, and essentially making her, you know, to blame for her death.
Mark, how do you read this film?
One of the things that we've seen a loss in the last two decades or so is really good quality investigative journalism. And when we do see it in this moment, it often takes several platforms in order to bring it out. And so it's kind of an achievement, you know, with the New York Times and Hulu and FX, you know, to be able to do this hour-long investigative, you know, examination of everything that led up to Breonna Taylor's death, the aftermath of it, to talk to the people that we needed to hear from in various different ways. And if folks weren't clear about why they should be upset about this case and everything that played out afterwards, you know, this series, this episode of this series does a really good job of helping us better understand this. There was no level of accountability, obviously, for many of the cops who were involved. And the idea that you would bring such a level of force to someone who wasn't even the primary target who at the time that you go after her and her boyfriend in that apartment, you had actually already captured the person who was the primary suspect in the case that you were building in this case. The fact that they did not have their top tier officers, right, you know, as it was described, kind of a ragtag gang of officers that were brought together. The fact that there were officers who shouldn't even have been still on the force, you know, given the kind of reports, you know, about them beforehand. It allowed us to counter the dehumanization that occurred, obviously, in Brianna's death, but also in terms of the way that they attempted to further kill her and her reputation afterwards. We got a sense of who she was and her humanity.
And I want to give listeners a sense of that, too, the killing of Breonna Taylor. Here's some audio from early on in the film. This is Breonna's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, giving his official statement to police just a few hours after they shot and killed her.
There was a loud bang at the door. She pops up out of her sleep and scared her to death. Me too. First thing she said, "Who is it?" No response. So we like, what the heck? We both get up, another knock at the door. She's like, "Who is it?" at the top of her lungs. No response. So then I grab my gun, which is legal, like I'm licensed to carry, and I've never even fired my gun outside of a range. I'm scared to death. When we get out of the bed or whatever, like walking towards the door like comes off the hinges. So I just let off one shot, and all of a sudden there's a whole lot of shots. Next thing I know, she's on the ground and the door's busted open and I'm yelling help because she's right here bleeding and nobody's coming and I'm just confused and scared and I feel the same right now.
Clip from the documentary, The Killing of Breonna Taylor, the New York Times Presents documentary. We're talking about it now on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and as we said, we expect later today, according to the Louisville Courier anyway, an announcement from the state attorney general. We're going out live today at noon. As of now, we have not heard from the attorney general. We expect that there may be an announcement about whether or not to file criminal charges against the white police officers involved. Later on today, we don't have that yet. Natalie, one of the things, you know, Mark was talking about investigative journalism, and it's happening in real time. We don't have to wait 6, 10, 20 years after the fact, I guess, to find out, you know, what went a little bit and ask some very serious questions about this investigation, right?
Right. I mean, when I said that the film, you know, doesn't do everything that I would want a documentary to do, I was really thinking about the fact that this is a different type of film. It's not really meant to, first of all, there isn't the time to, lend like a serious artistic flair to the documentary. This is about revealing information and facts that we have been without up to this moment. When I think about Breonna Taylor and this film, I think about immediately films that Jay-Z executive produced for Trayvon Martin and for Khalif Browder, who, although he did not die at the hands of the police, he certainly died at the hands of the criminal justice system. And there is a treatment to these stories that is really compelling and beautiful and, I think, you know, does justice to the great injustice that happened in those cases. With this film, because it's done in the midst of, continued investigation into what actually happened, it takes on a different, more urgent, more immediate tone. It doesn't have the benefit of reflection and meditation on, how are we going to present the facts and the details of what happened to Breonna and who she is in a way that is, you know, that really allows us to delve deep into her as a person? We need to, you know, sort of set the record straight. In many ways. And so I think the film does that, and I think it does it well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things that you can do in real time, where you can't get to the bottom of everything because not all of the information is available. You can be able to bust some myths, which are critical in the moment, the myth-making right. about who was responsible and whether or not Breonna had a record. By talking to her friends and family, you get a very different picture. Here's a clip of Bree's mom talking about Bree.
She was a better version of me, though. She was, yeah. just full of life, just easy to love. She had a smile out of this world.
Tamiku Palmer talking about her late daughter, Breonna Taylor. That cut from the new documentary, The Killing of Breonna Taylor. So, Mark, again, later today, and there may be some people listening to this on the rebroadcast that may already know about this, but what do you expect this moment, noon today, on Wednesday? What are you expecting? What do you think might come out of that attorney general's office today?
What you learn about a case like this, and the film really hammers this home, bad policing, bad training, and anti-blackness is always going to end up deadly and tragic, you know, for black communities. The fact that we've waited so long to even get the chance for an indictment, and we know there have been indictments in the past, but very often those indictments don't lead to convictions, and then we have to go about the civil suit route. And what we see is that time and time again, municipalities are much more willing to take resources from their communities, financial resources from their community, to pay out in terms of a civil suit, than to actually deal with transforming policing in their communities. And I don't expect this case to be any different.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Also, Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Back Channel continues. We remember actor Chadwick Boseman and musician Ronald Bell, among one of the founding members of Kool and the Gang. And we'll be back on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel today with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. And I want to bring our conversation around to Chadwick Boseman, the actor who died from colon cancer at the age of 43 in late August, known for his roles as Jackie Robinson and James Brown, and then, of course, embodied the parrot character of the Black Panther in the blockbuster Marvel movie series. Mark, looking back at his career, what do you think Chadwick Boseman's legacy is?
So many impactful roles in really a short period of time, you know, taking on iconic figures in terms of Jackie Robinson and James Brown, and then also Thurgood Marshall, and then embodying, you know, in T'Challa, an iconic fictional figure. And, you know, we tend, the American society often looks back at a figure like James Dean and talks about how impactful he was in a short period of time. And it really was just that one film. With Chadwick, we have a larger body of work, but my, you know, what he was able to pack into those 7 or 8 years, you know, it's a traumatic loss, obviously, for his family and for folks who cared about him. And we won't get to see in a fuller maturity, you know, what he would have been able to do on screen and in life. And it's just heartbreaking. You know, there's not much else to say.
Natalie, what are your thoughts?
Well, I share a lot of, you know, what Mark just shared. You know, I think representation, I mean, we talk a lot about representation on this program. And I think, you know, Chadwick was devoted to a certain type of representation of Black people. And it's so obvious to me that he made a choice early on. And I have no doubt that his time at Howard University, of which I'm a proud alumna, you know, had an impact on him. And that he decided that he was only going to play roles that allowed him to represent the Black folks that he was representing in a way that would bring pride and dignity to the people he comes from. And it's remarkable to me that he, even in the midst of battling stage 4 colon cancer, you know, still churned out, I think, at least 2 projects, one of which was Black Panther. So the dedication that he had, just the strength of character and resilience to be battling a horrific sickness and still be committed to only doing certain types of work and doing it at an extremely high level.
Well, and let's hear what he has to say about that. Chadwick Boseman making this acceptance speech at the 2019 Screen Actor Guild Awards, where Black Panther cast won the award for outstanding performance by a cast in a motion picture.
We know what it's like to be told to say there's not a screen for you to be featured on, a stage for you to be featured on. We know what it's like to be the tail and not the head. We know what it's like to be beneath and not above. And that is what we went to work with every day, because we knew not that we would be around during award season or that it would make $1 billion, but we knew that we had something special that we wanted to give the world, that we could be full human beings in the roles that we were playing, that we could create a world that exemplified a world that we wanted to see. We knew that we had something that we wanted to give, and to come to work with every day and to solve problems with this group of people every day with this director, that is something that I wish all actors would get the opportunity to experience.
Chadwick Boseman at the 2019 Screen Actor Guild Awards. We're talking about his legacy today on Back Channel, remembering him and others. Earlier this month, we lost Ronald Bell, one of the founding members of Kool & the Gang. The songwriter, vocalist, producer, and saxophonist was 68 years old. Mark Anthony Neal, tell us about Ronald Bell's life and musical legacy.
Yeah, you know, he and his brother co-founded this band out of New Jersey in the mid to late 60s. They were really into jazz. And like many of their peers that period of time that played jazz but wanted an audience and wanted to sell records, they started to gravitate to funk music. And they were a very successful funk band in the early to mid-1970s. When you think about classics like Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swinging, you know, which a whole new generation got introduced to via Roll Bounce, you know, 20 years later. And he and his brother really thought through what it meant to be a band that was connected to community. And then when they had a lull during the disco era, you know, they had the wherewithal to add a singer for just that role in J.T. Taylor. And then they became a major pop force, you know, beginning with songs like Ladies Night and Celebration and so many other classic hits from the early 1980s.
Natalie, I know this death hit you personally in a lot of ways because of the time period in which they were coming around.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, you know, as Mark was naming some of the hits, you know, I grew up when J.T. Taylor was, or I was growing up when J.T. Taylor became kind of central to Kool & the Gang. I didn't really realize that Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swingin' were Kool & the Gang, because I was like, well, you know, I was looking for that voice, for JT's voice. And since it wasn't there, I assumed clearly that's not Kool & the Gang. But the pop period of Kool & the Gang was so central to the soundtrack of my like formative years as a middle schooler and high schooler. And I mean, I, you know, as we often do, I have specific memories, related to Celebration, related to Too Hot, related to Diana. You know, their music was, sort of in many ways, kind of the bread and butter of that time for me and for a lot of folks from my generation. And I mean, Mark is really a part of my generation as well. So there's so much that, kind of hit me when I found out about Bell's death, because I, you know, it's like you're losing a family member, because they were such a big part of, you know, your life. Even though I never met him, you know, wouldn't necessarily know him on the street. But his music, what he created, what his band meant during that time period when I was growing up, you know, it's kind of priceless to really put into words.
And you make an interesting point, too. You may not have known him if they walked past you on the street. Funk was big at the time, but we think of Sly and the Family Stone. We think of James Brown. Those were kind of charismatic band leaders who everybody knew. Kool & the Gang, really an ensemble, right, Mark?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And pretty much stayed solidly the same group for a good 10 or 12 years. You know, Natalie talked about kind of the personal memories. You know, they Get Down On It, you know, was a song that was played at my 16th birthday at a skating party. And whenever I hear that song, I'm back in the Bronx at the Skate Key, you know, for my birthday party. So, yeah. And it was at a time when, you know, you had music that impacted upon communities, but you didn't necessarily have that kind of touch with the artists themselves. You didn't necessarily know what they looked like. You know, there was no Instagram and Twitter and all those kinds of things. So there really was a connection directly with the music more than anything.
Well, we lost another artist, Mark, who had, I think you had a close connection with, at least in terms of your appreciation for his music, DJ Rogers, the soul singer and songwriter who died at the age of 72 in late August. Let's just play a little bit of his music. This is a little bit of Say You Love Me.
I'm the one your eyes see. Tell me you need me deep down inside like I need you. You see, I need you to see me through. I wanna hear you say, darling.
A little bit of Say You Love Me from soul singer-songwriter DJ Rogers, who passed away in late August. Talking about his legacy now with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, tell us more about this artist and how you discovered him.
Yeah, you know, DJ Rogers was an L.A. guy. You know, had a start recorded as a gospel artist and then made that kind of leap into secular music and recorded his first album on Leon Russell's label in Oklahoma, Leon Russell, who wrote a song for you. Some of his backing vocals were, you know, members of the Gap Band, you know, which we know from Uncle Charlie at this point in time. But he was an original in an era where there were so many powerful voices. His whole thing really was to take seriously the connection between gospel music and soul music. And Donny Hathaway did that, and you know, Rance Island did that, and of course Billy Preston did that. But there was just something really unique about the way that DJ Rogers did it. And I didn't hear DJ Rogers in my house when I was growing up. I was a teenager when I heard Say You Love Me on the radio. Vaughn Harper played it during his Quiet Storm show in New York, and I was like, I have never heard anything like this before, and literally spent a decade, you know, trying to track down a copy of it, and bought a beat up copy of it on a street corner in Harlem for about $2, and it really was a metaphor for the kind of career that he had, that voice that and music that people appreciated, but never really was in the limelight the way some of his peers were.
Natalie, what's your take on DJ Rogers' legacy?
Yeah, well, you know what? He's a perfect example of, you know, what we were talking about in terms of not, you know, recognized. I would never have recognized DJ Rogers on the street. I didn't even know that he sang that song, that he sang Say You Love Me. So when I realized that, I was like, oh, my gosh, because that's a song that was, I loved that song. I loved Natalie Cole's remake of it. And it's emblematic to me of a certain sound that, you know, Mark was describing, this melding of soul and gospel that I feel like comes up in the vocals and maybe even the arrangement of a lot of songs of that period. For instance, Roy Ayers, You Send Me, his remake of the Sam Cooke song, is in that era. There's a certain sound that DJ Rogers was a part of, you know, really promoting and making popular. And that is, again, a part of my, like, it was a part of my early childhood, but I didn't really grow to appreciate it until, kind of like Mark, I heard it on the Quiet Storm when I was a student at Howard. And Melvin Lindsay was playing it. So it's just very interesting how in this social media age, we get to, you know, kind of feel like we know the artists that make the music of this moment, right? But back in the day, unless you have the album in your house, right, with a picture of the person on the album, you had no idea who was creating the music. You just knew that it connected with you and you loved it.
Well, we've lost some important sports figures recently as well. Major League Baseball Hall of Famer Lou Brock was 81. Mark, talk about Lou Brock's impact on the game.
Man, it was his generation, that first generation of black players that came into the major leagues, and one of their early contributions was to introduce speed. And initially it was Maury Wills, who set the single-season stolen base record back in 62. But then Lou Brock came along, right? And Lou Brock, unlike Maury Wills, was actually a very good hitter, was a great fielder, was an important part of those great St. Louis teams in the late 1960s, all the way through, to the end of his career in 1979. In 1974, he set the single-season record, stealing 104 bases, that then later got broken by Ricky Henderson, and then, of course, was the stolen base career leader for a long time until, that was also surpassed by Ricky Henderson. But, he was that emblem of what black players meant to the league at that period of time. And also one of those last generations of black players that came from HBCUs and went on to the major leagues when the HBCUs were still a pipeline. And he got immortalized, much later in his life, through a Tribe Called Quest on the song Check the Rhymes. And, when Q-Tip dropped that line, got the scrawny legs, but I moved just like Lou Brock. Kind of a pop culture reference also.
Well, we should also note that today we learned that Gale Sayers, the Chicago Bears Hall of Fame running back, died. He was 77 years old. I want to turn now to the hit HBO show Lovecraft Country, a show that was adapted from the novel by Matt Ruff, created by Misha Green. And just to give you a sense of this, because this is a kind of a sci-fi thriller in some ways. Some of the scariest characters in it are white people. I'm going to play a clip from the show, talk about some of the blatant racism that plays out in Lovecraft Country. Here our heroes Tick, Uncle George, and Letty run into a racist sheriff. We're going to take a listen, and a warning, this clip does include a racial slur.
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. If I had found you pissing in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees.
It's not sundown yet.
Sunset is at 7:09 today. That's 7 minutes from now.
Then we'll be out of the county in six.
Now that's impossible heading south on the road you're currently on, unless you were to speed. And if you were to speed, I'd have to pull you over.
Then we'll head north.
That might work. Why don't you give it a try?
We will, sir.
Is it legal to make a U-turn here? Aren't you a smart one? Now, ordinarily, I would consider a U-turn a violation. But if you ask me real nice, I might just let it go this time. Please. Oh, you can do better than that. Say, pretty please, will you let this smart nigga make a U-turn here?
Pretty please, will you let this smart nigga make a U-turn here?
All right. Just this one time, since you asked so nicely.
That's a clip from Lovecraft Country on HBO. Natalie Bullock Brown, give us your sense of this series.
Okay, well, first of all, it just is insane. But I love it because it is, the treatment of race and racism is just, I think, so brilliant. And in a scene like what we just heard, which seems to be, which on its face value is something that, we kind of are familiar with, right? We know how, a scene between black folk and police officers can play out, both in 1954, 55, when Lovecraft Country is set, and today. But I think part of the brilliance of the series is that there's this like veneer of what is quote unquote real, like what is familiar in terms of racism, what we think we understand about it, the surface of it. But then there's all this, I think it's allegory and symbolism that really speaks to the horrors and absurdity of racism. That's, you know, packed in with all kinds of supernatural elements that I will not spoil for those of you who've not watched it. But it is just an incredible commentary, episode after episode of, you know, what Black folks deal with on a regular basis in this country, and having to negotiate and navigate racism in ways that actually allow them to come out of those negotiations with their humanity and dignity intact. It's just really brilliantly done. And I just encourage folks, don't watch it late at night. You need to watch it in the afternoon.
I tell you what, we're going to continue our conversation about Lovecraft Country and much, much more on Back Channel on the State of Things Today with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. When our show continues, please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel Today with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And before the break, we were talking about Lovecraft Country. Mark Anthony Neal, we talk about the significance of this being a sci-fi thriller series and the fact that it's named for, I assume, H.P. Lovecraft, whose own science fiction is suffused with racism. There's a lot going on in the series, is there not?
There's no question the novel was an attempt to push back against Lovecraft's racism and so much of his work. And so in that regard, you know, it does really important work. But more importantly, it also focuses on the fact that there's always been an interest amongst Black Americans about science fiction, right? Whether we're talking about Du Bois writing his Dark Tower series, you know, in the 1920s, or, you know, folks that we talk about more so now, like N.K. Jemisin and folks like that. So it really delves in that particular dynamic. And again, it's so vivid that scene in the first episode when, you know, they're stopped by the cops and the monsters show up and you're relieved that the monsters show up, right? It's absolutely ridiculous, but also the storytelling, because it is so layered and it's gesturing to so many things that are happening in history, right? The fact that Emmett Till is a character in the story, but you would only know that if you knew what his nickname was when he was in Chicago. The fact that, you know, for folks who didn't understand what rough riding was in reference to Freddie Gray in Baltimore, you know, in 2014, you get a case of that in the story, right? So it does all of these gestures. There's so many other things that are happening in Black life.
Lots more to say about this, but I want to change gears now because this year is the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which granted women the right to vote. But the stories that are told around this anniversary are leaving out some of the most important players, Black women. Martha S. Jones corrects that record with her new book, Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers and Won the Vote and Insisted on Equality for All. She is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University and joins us now. Martha S. Jones, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks very much for having me.
This work, I understand, is really personal for you, and you can see that in the introduction of your book, which features the activism of the women in your own family. Tell us how you came to this work and how the role that they played in your writing of this book.
I always work with them in mind, and I became a little self-conscious as I was finishing this book, and I realized I really didn't know the stories of my grandmother, for example, and where she was in 1920, whether she had been able to vote. So I took a detour in the research, looked for her in Missouri where she'd lived, and finally found her in Greensboro in North Carolina in the 1920s. I still didn't find the record of her voting, but eventually I found an interview that she'd given in 1978 to historian Bill Chafe, in which she talked about voting rights. And interestingly, she didn't talk about 1920 at all. She talked about the 1950s and 60s and how important a period that was for Black women in voting. And it really affirmed the premise of this book, which is that we can't end the story of Black women in the vote in 1920 We have to come forward all the way to 1965 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act in that year.
And I think among the many points you make is that the right to vote by itself was never a singular goal for black women, at least not in the early 20th century. What role did intersectionality and some of the other issues that black women were facing play in their activism?
For a long time in our history, black women are quite alone in offering up a political vision for American democracy, a vision of a democracy that does not trade in racism and does not trade in sexism. That is the principle that black women will enunciate at the beginning of the 19th century, and they will carry that all the way forward. By the end of the 19th century, black women's political fates are very much tied to the fates of their husbands, their fathers, and their sons. And that means that they must take on the scourge of Jim Crow, including racial violence, alongside promoting votes for women. So within an organization like the National Association of Colored Women, black women work through multiple issues, including the right to vote, including anti-lynching legislation, and a great deal more.
And a lot of that activism, you point out, actually began well before the early part of the 20th century. It begins in churches, black churches, in 19th century America. Tell us more about that.
I know for some listeners that'll be a surprise that a story about women in the vote begins in church. But the politics of the black church are not only legendary, they are critical to understanding the long story of how black women come to voting rights. I write about a black woman preacher at the dawn of the 19th century who within the African Methodist Episcopal Church is looking to get a preaching license. And Jerina Lee not only wages that campaign, she begins to articulate a political philosophy that informs her activism, again, coming back to the intersectional vision that calls for the eradication of racism and sexism in American public life. And her ideas, her contributions as a thinker as well as an activist are fundamental to understanding how African American women ultimately come to think about the vote.
Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown are still with us on this. And Mark, I know you've read this and you've also talked to Martha. And, you know, what are your thoughts and questions about this book and the impact that it's had on our understanding of black women's role in voting rights?
You know, because of figures like Stacey Abrams, in recent years, you know, we've been forced to kind of double down on the fact that black women voters are so critical, you know, to the ambitions and desires of the black community and the Democratic Party in particular in terms of the electorate. And it's not a brand new phenomenon. I think one of the things that Vanguard does very well is to show the fact that there's a long game here. There's a longer history about that impact. And I would want to ask, you know, Martha, given the tensions of this particular moment, how important was it to write this story now, not only because it marks its centennial, but because it also marks another moment where black women's voices are so critical to the electoral process?
Thank you, Mark. I've come to speak of black women in 2020 politics as a force. And that is to say, rather than marking black women's first, such as the nomination of Senator Harris to the Democratic ticket, I think we really have to finally reckon with the entire picture. Yes, Senator Harris, but Senator Harris was not alone among those who were on Vice President Biden's shortlist. There were six black women because black women were ready for this political moment to step into it and to be forceful candidates for the vice presidency. There are more than 120 black women running for Congress this year alongside Senator Harris. This is a record-shattering number of black women. The high mark had been 48 women 4 years ago in 2016. And then, of course, as you allude to, the force of black women at the polls who not only vote as a bloc, but also turn out to the polling place on Election Day in record numbers. These factors, I think you're right, are clearly must be reckoned with by the Democratic Party and more, but leads someone like me, a historian like me, to appreciate the 200 years of political activism that have brought us to this moment, as Senator Harris explained during her acceptance speech. She stands on the shoulders of many great women. These are not women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan Anthony, but instead women like Mary McLeod Bethune and Mary Church Terrell and many others.
Annette? Yeah, Natalie.
Okay. Martha, if I may, as you know, there's a lot about Black women that kind of gets left out of the larger narrative of not only this country, but certainly voting rights. And so thank you for all that you do to illuminate the roles that we have played. But I think that there's still like lingers this confusion around who actually got the right to vote in 1920 and what happened between the ratification of the 19th Amendment and then the 1965 Voting Rights Act that makes Black women's role in the electoral process so murky. It just seems like we fall out of the story. And I know that we're there.
You know, there are a lot of myths that surround the 19th Amendment. Part of my job is to try and dispel them. Right? One is that the 19th Amendment guaranteed or won women the right to vote. The 19th Amendment does no such thing. All it does is prohibit the states from using sex as an arbiter of voting rights. And as a consequence, African-American women are kept from the polls in many states by Jim Crow laws, poll taxes, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and other impediments that had already been keeping Black men from the polls. So not all women is part of the answer. And at the same time, Black women are at the polls in some states, notably California and Illinois and New York, even before 1920, and are proving their capacity not only to navigate politics, but to use the force of their vote to affect change. But I do think that the history of this movement was written first and foremost by women who had, like Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had a vested interest in a sense, promoting their own role in the movement and promoting their own facets of the movement. And for a long time, historians relied upon a six-volume history, almost 6,000 pages, written by Stanton and Anthony and their allies that left Black women, including the roles they played in the suffrage movement and then the ways in which Black women organize more broadly in their clubs and in their sororities, in civil rights organizations to voting rights work. None of that appears in the history of women's suffrage. And so part of our work is to surface that. And I must credit the great historian, Dr. Rosalind Terborg Penn, for really cracking the code on those volumes and teaching us how to find Black women in the archives, despite the kinds of histories that had so dominated our understanding for a long time.
I would actually be curious about that, because that is part of the business of erasing people from history, is erasing the record, or at least obscuring the record. So how do you find and where did you find the evidence that you did to daylight the story?
Well, it turns out, Frank, that when you ask the question about Black women in the vote, Black women in politics, Black women have left us a vibrant and critical record of their work. I mentioned Jerina Lee, the early 19th century preacher. Well, in 1936, Jerina Lee steps off the preaching circuit long enough to write a memoir, which is published and we can return to appreciate the politics embedded in her church activism. So much of my work was aided by Black women historical figures themselves, who in various ways, whether it's through memoir, through diaries, whether it's in newspapers and more, they leave us a record of not only their activism, but of their speeches. And part of the work of Vanguard was to consolidate and bring together those voices so that Black women are telling their own histories of the vote and political rights.
In digging into these documents and finding these stories, what took you by surprise?
I don't think I was prepared for the ubiquitousness of violence in this story. I certainly knew about the violence that we associate with the modern civil rights era and the voting campaigns as told by women like Fannie Lou Hamer, Diane Nash, and others. I didn't recognize until I wrote this book that story of when and how, when Black women move into the public sphere, when they claim political rights, when they travel as lecturers and public speakers, the ways in which violence attended that work, essentially, it is, I'm sorry to say, I think linked to the place that you all began this story, this program this afternoon, with the tragic death of Breonna Taylor. Black women have understood for a very long time the role of state violence and how state violence has been one technology that has aimed to keep them from political rights.
Given the barriers, the twin scourges of Jim Crow and also sexism that women faced, and the fact that, you know, even after emancipation, it was clear that white folks were not going to relinquish the privilege of voting to Black people and a generation in, what do you think allowed women to remain confident that, that any kind of activism would even succeed or be worth their time?
Partly, Vanguard is a story about what Black women do when they cannot vote. Which is to say, Black women are not pining for the vote or sitting on their hands or waiting for that turn to happen in American politics. And so before they are voters, they are organizers. Before they are voters, they are lobbyists. Before they are voters, they are activists and organizers. And this means that Black women know very well not only the ins and outs of American politics, but they know how to eke out resources, political victories, and the modicum of power despite disfranchisement. No one better exemplifies that than the great Mary McLeod Bethune, who, though disfranchised violently in the state of Florida in 1920s, comes to Washington and organizes Franklin Roosevelt's Black Cabinet, goes on to be present at the founding meeting of the United Nations as a delegate. Bethune knew how to do an end run around disfranchisement, and this empowered her and the many women in her orbit. That's part of the story.
Martha S. Jones is the author of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. She is a Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. Martha, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you all for having me.
And thank you to Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. And he is the co-host, the host, I should say, of the webcast Left of Black, Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Mark, Natalie, thank you so much as well.
Thank you as always, Frank.
You can find out more about this show at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Widarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.